We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to perpetualchesspod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess, Chess Books Recaptured. This, of course, is a monthly chess book review show, a bonus pod, if you will, where we talk about a beloved chess book. Often it's a classic. Sometimes it's a book that we think should be a classic. And joining me is a longtime friend of the pod. He is a cognitive scientist, the co-author of the New York Times bestseller, Invisible Gorilla. Hopefully you guys all have heard him. He's been interviewed on Perpetual Chess. We've reviewed books together before. And of course, he's achieved many even greater things than being on Perpetual Chess in his life. He's also a chess dad and a chess bibliophile, as always comes across when we get to talking. So let's welcome Christopher Chabris back to the show. Welcome, Christopher.
Thanks for having me back.
Always good to have you. And I love that you're one of the people, Chris, who's figured out that obviously there's tons of people I want to interview on Perpetual Chess more than I ever can. So you're one of the people they figured out the easiest way in is if you offer to review a book. And obviously you always come prepared. So I greatly appreciate it.
It's a good thing. It gives me a good incentive to actually read a chess book also.
Yeah, and this one, as we've discussed, quite an ambitious undertaking. So we're discussing the mammoth book of the world's greatest chess games. So basically, the idea of this book is a compilation of what the authors determined to be the 145 best chess games of all time. And the authors obviously know of what they speak. FIDE Master Graham Burgess, who we just interviewed and will be playing that interview for you later, he's sort of the leader of the project, but Grandmaster John Nunn has been involved, Grandmaster John Ems, more recently, Grandmaster Michael Adams, Grandmaster Wesley. So all pitching in and evaluating these classic games and providing amazing annotations. So it's a great book. And Chris, it was you who suggested that we this be the book that we cover. So what's been your relationship with this mammoth game book?
Well, the first edition of this, it's actually in its fourth edition now, and there are a few chess books that have gone into four editions, and it's stayed around. They keep coming out with new editions and making it better, and I finally realized that this is a classic book because it keeps on selling for the last 24 years, and it keeps on getting better. And when it first came out, which was, I believe, in 1998, the first edition that had 100 games, I saw it on the bookshelf in a bookstore like a Barnes & Noble or something like that. And I said, what's this? I've never heard of this publisher before. This is not Batsford or Gambit or, you know, Pergamon or whatever all the publishers were. So I kind of ignored it because it looked kind of like a little like mass market paperback, you know, like a thriller novel or something like that, you know, small size and so on. But then it kept on coming out in these new editions. And finally, I realized that it's basically a book put together by the same team that does all the great Gambit chess books. John Nunn, Graham Burgess, John Ems, that whole crowd that have done so many great books over the years. They just made a book for a different publisher. And I guess Graham, you know, he told us sort of how that came about, and we'll hear it in his interview. But finally, when I saw the fourth edition was coming out, I couldn't believe they were doing another edition after 10 years. And it felt right to me, like a good time to go back and go over the classics. Like a lot of the games in this book I had seen when I was very young. I hadn't seen a lot of them since then. And there were all kinds of games in here that I had never seen. And it just felt like a good time to go over the classics. And we always talk about how for improvement, you should study the classics. That's one of the common things that, you know, grandmasters say, trainers say, and so on. I'm trying to get better. A lot of people are trying to get better. Where do you find the classics? Well, here's a book with 145 of them with impeccable analysis and selection. And they, you know, as we'll discuss, they have like a whole system for selecting the games. They have criteria, not to say they're perfect in their decisions, but it felt like the right time to do this. And it really feels like a book that everybody should know about. And of the very few books that, you know, everyone should have who likes chess books.
Yeah, it's kind of like one-stop shopping for chess culture, but it's more than that because the games are so instructive. And obviously, you know, it covers all phases of the game, being that they're complete games. So you learn a bit about openings. Obviously, the middle games are kind of like the, you know, the main attraction. There's just some incredibly tactical melee type positions like peppered throughout. And then obviously there's some classic end games as well. So you get a little bit of everything, and they have criteria where they weighed the books based on the historical significance as well as sort of the quality of the game. So you're learning chess history as you go. So obviously this My Great Predecessors by Kasparov gets mentioned a lot in this regard, but this is kind of like a condensed version of it. It's not so condensed. The paper version is 800 pages, and this has been a big project, but compared to the multi-volume My Great Predecessors, it is shorter. And yeah, just a fantastic resource. And I actually feel, Chris, like, you know, being that I'm asking people what their favorite chess books are basically every week, I was surprised to hear Graham say that the other mammoth book, and we should probably say, because I didn't know this, that part of the reason it has the title Mammoth is that this is like a series that goes beyond chess, kind of like the Four Dummies series or the Complete Idiot's Guide to series. So that was the genesis of the project, as you'll hear Graham explain, but that's why it has what otherwise I might consider an unusual title. But anyway, it hasn't been recommended that often on the podcast. I remember Mezgin Amanov in one of my very early interviews said that it was a fantastic book. I think he was referring to the regular Mammoth book, and we should be clear, there's a games and then there's a sort of general chess, which is, again, sort of in the vein of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Chess, where the idea is if you're new to chess and you want one book that's going to teach you as much as you can handle, it's a book that you'll acquire. But this one is the games one, so probably for a slightly more advanced audience. Of course, because it's all these grandmasters judging the highest quality games, it's very concrete at times. I mean, it's just unavoidable that if you're having two heavyweights slug it out in some tactical slugfest like Kasparov, Topalov, or whatever it may be, then there's going to be a lot of variations if you want to learn to appreciate it. But they did an amazing job, and yeah, it's been fun to go through it.
Well, speaking of weight, it's heavy. It is 814 pages plus an about the author's page, and it's 145 games. So if you do the math, each game is about 5 to 6 pages, I think it comes out as. And, you know, it's fair. I would say it's fairly dense. Like, they don't waste space, you know, they don't waste space in there at all. So you're getting tremendous value for the money. For anyone who like tries to calculate the value of their books, you know, per dollar spent, even the paperback is $25 US, and you've got 145 of the best games ever with excellent notes. And the Kindle edition appears to be periodically go on sale for as low as $3. So I don't think there's any better value in chess books than this either.
Yeah, I agree. And as we're recording this on a Monday, March 20th or so, this will likely be out by Friday, but it's $3 as we speak. And yeah, this is the kind of book that you could read, you could spend more than a month reading it once per year and read it every year and still gain from it. I also wanted to mention, we mentioned all the authors involved, but the foreword is by none other than Viswanathan Anand. So they have some just incredible heavy hitters. And I wanted to read the lead by Anand. So the first thing you read when you open the book in the foreword, which is Anand says, "In virtually every sport, there's the debate about who was the greatest of all time and which was the best contest. Comparisons made over long periods of time are far from simple. Comparing the tennis players of the past with those of today must take into account advances such as carbon fiber rackets and scientifically designed training programs. A further difficulty is that for events predating television, one often has to rely on written descriptions rather than video records. Chess is in a uniquely fortunate position in this respect. Chess notation means that the great games of the past can be played over just as easily as those played last week. This book aims to present the best 145 games of all time." Yeah, and as we ask Graham about, there are one or two notable omissions, because, Chris, what do you consider to be the most famous chess game of all time?
The most famous chess game of all time? Well, I know what you're going to say.
Yeah.
I don't know. You might be right about what the most famous game of all time is. I can think of some games that I thought were omitted from this, and it's not a knock on the book, but there are some interesting ones missing, I think, that we can talk about also. But I'll go with your answer to what's the most famous game of all time.
Yeah, which of course is Paul Morphy's opera game. And we do discuss with Graham why that didn't make the cut. And I thought he had a fantastic answer. I mean, first of all, we already had an inkling, because they talk about, again, one of the criteria being the quality of the game. So it can't just be quality on one side. It has to be a hard fought game. And of course, you know, all, shout out to the Duke and the Count, but they didn't play that well in the opera game. But so it makes sense why the games aren't included, being that they have this pure process of just judging it based on their voting, and they don't put their thumbs on the scale, as you'll hear Graham discuss. So in that sense, I think it's kind of silly to even nitpick. And the bottom line is, in these 145 games, there's just an incredible array of quality games. And I'd probably, you know, obviously I've read my share of chess books, and I feel like I only consciously remembered having seen maybe 65% of them before, something like that, in that neighborhood. And they're such amazing games that even if you have seen them before, often it's been a long time. So how many of these games struck you as new versus memorable?
That is a great question. I should have kept track of that as I was going through them. You said you could spend a month on it. I spent several months on it, because I actually played through, I would say, about 97% of all of the notes. So I read it on the Gambit Chess Studio app, which is kind of like the Forward Chess app and the other ones where you can play through the analysis and so on your phone or tablet or whatever. So it took me quite a long time to get through all of that. And I should have made notes as I went along on which ones were new to me. Several of the recent ones were new to me. And there were some ones from, I would say, the 60s and the 50s that I had never seen before. A lot of the older ones are very much classics that, you know, many readers, especially people who are, you know, players interested in chess books, you know, will have seen, because they show up in other anthologies of great games and other, you know, great players' best games collections and so on. They're in there too. But unlike my great predecessors, also, it's not just about world champions or the super top players. Like, there are several games by players who were nowhere close to being world champion, but just produced a great game, and several games by contemporary players who have not ever made the candidates tournament even, but who have played several great games. I'm thinking of Dubov in particular, got two games in the current edition. And, you know, he's one of everybody's favorite players, but, you know, he's not even been in the candidates tournament yet. So he's not going to be in, you know, those other kinds of books.
Yeah. But again, when you play through the games, I mean, they're all pretty impressive. So it makes sense in that respect. And yeah, it's lots of fun. And we're going to play the interview that we did with Graham for you. But just quickly, before we do that, maybe we should discuss other comparable game selection books. I mean, it's hard, you know, I don't know if there is that much that's comparable, but certainly there have been many other sort of assorted games books, and then what the sort of hook is or what the sort of idea behind it can vary greatly. Obviously, there's something like Chernov's 100 Most Instructive Games of All Time, and there's Logical Chess Move by Move, which is like some are picked for their instructive value. Of course, Kasparov's Great Predecessors picked for their sort of historic value and to make sure you show different players. Do you have any favorite game collection books, Chris?
Yeah, I think this is really a unique book in that it does attempt to cover all of chess history and select only on the basis of games, not on the basis of players. You know, there are books of, like, My Great Predecessors, for example, is one that's based on players. Chernev also had a book called The Golden Dozen, which was games of the players he thought were the best 12 of all time. There are the collections of instructive games. You just mentioned a couple of them. There are some newer ones too. Understanding Chess Move by Move is a great modern one by John Nunn, which is sort of picking out instructive games. Those games, I think, tend to be more one-sided and of somewhat lower quality because a lot of the instruction comes from seeing how one player executed a plan successfully and, you know, exploited strategic, you know, weaknesses and so on, or opening mistakes. This is really kind of a unique game. The closest book I can think of is one by Andy Soltis, who came out with a book on the 100 best games of the 20th century ranked. So he actually printed them in rank order. And that's an interesting one to compare to this one, because most of the books from the Mammoth Book of the World's Greatest Chess Games are from the 20th century, since that's, that's just when most of the games that we know were played. There are so many more games played then than before then. There are a number of books which are sort of shorter periods, like the best games of the 70s, the best games of the 60s. Another one that I think gets overlooked a little bit is the Informant folks came out with a book of, so every issue of Chess Informant, have people, panel of grandmasters and top annotators, right, vote on the best games of the previous issue. So if you compile all those tables, they made the 1,000 best games covering about a 40-year period from 1966 to 2007. That's 1,000 games. It's not annotated, but it's a comparable, you know, sort of effort to pick on the basis of games, no matter who played them in what tournament, you know, and so on. So I think those are some of the comparable ones. There's some good lists online that you can get to of great games, like Chessbase has a, you know, 200 games for replay training or something like that. But a lot of those are also sort of oriented towards instructional value, as opposed to this kind of admirable attempt that the authors of this book made to sort of pick as much as possible on the basis of quality of the game, as opposed to some other criterion, although instructional value was one of their criteria also, as well as historical value too.
Yeah. And speaking of the instructional value, one thing I think we should mention is, I mean, the games themselves do sparkle, so anyone can appreciate this book, but because they judged on the quality of the game and they wanted it to be fighting from both sides, that means that, again, there are going to be moments that are extremely concrete. So for that reason, I would say, in terms of like what rating level might most appreciate this book, my personal guess is maybe from like 1600 USCF FIDE on up, you might benefit most because, again, there's just complex ideas being illustrated, tactical melees and variations that one just simply has to go through. Of course, Chris, having spent more time on this project than I did, went through them in more detail than I did, but I was able to appreciate what was lacking in my hurried approach in order to get through this. So I would give that warning, but I mean, as we said, it's a book that even if you're below 1600, playing through the moves, playing through the games, you will be impressed. And it's definitely the kind of book that you can pick up and come back to repeatedly over the years. So even beyond that, it's worth getting, especially if you're spending $3 on Kindle. And one other thing to add is it's available in various formats. I mean, there's the book, there's Kindle, and as Chris mentioned, the Chess Studio app, which I have to be honest, I found the app a bit clunky. Chris and I were talking before we recorded. He didn't mind it as much. It took some getting used to for me, but since whenever there isn't an air quote ebook where you can play through the moves on the app, since I complain whenever there isn't one, the fact that it exists and that I was able to consume the book that way is obviously a major plus. And the app is free. You just buy the book. I think it was like $12 or something like that.
Yeah, the book is cheap in the app. Yeah. You get the whole book, plus you can play through it. Plus there's a, I don't know, maybe a 8-year-old vintage engine in it or something like that, or a 6-year-old vintage engine in it. So you can get some, you know, help, like, you know, if there's ever a move you don't understand at all, why can't he do this? Well, just tap the engine button and then you'll be told why that move is no good in a couple of seconds. I'm a bigger fan of the Gambit app. Maybe it's just because like all the Gambit books are on the Gambit app and I like Gambit books so much, but nobody should be confused. This book is not published by Gambit. It's published by a company called Robinson that publishes all these mammoth books. I guess Graham will explain all that to us, but you get it on the Gambit chess app, which is called Chess Studio. So it's kind of a weird situation there. I guess the other thing I would say is you don't have to play through all the variations in this. Like, there are a lot of variations. It's a very concrete style of analysis, which is part of what I think Gambit books are known for, is really prizing like accuracy and really explaining what was going on and why. But there's lots of textual notes, and each game ends with like three tips. I forget exactly what they call them, but sort of like points to remember, instructional points from the game. And a lot of those are very pithy. Hopefully later we can read some of them, because I think there were a lot of great nuggets of advice there that you get right after seeing a whole game that illustrates it, which is really cool, I thought.
Yeah, there are a lot of nice touches in the presentation. Definitely aim to discuss that further. But first, Chris, I think we should play the interview before we step on anything else that Graham revealed. So I think listeners will have enough context now to appreciate the fact that, you know, this has been like a life pursuit for Graham and his co-authors. But yeah, began in 1998 and been updating it ever since. And the chess world is the greater for it. So Chris and I both enjoyed that interview. So we're going to take a break and play it for you. And then Chris and I will be back to discuss the book a little more. And then we've also, since it's always a pleasure to have Chris on the podcast, and, you know, he's got the knowledge of the unique intersection of chess and cognitive science, we have a couple unrelated to the book questions that we'll catch up with Chris on when we get back from the interview, which we will play for you after this break. Listeners, I just got an update from aimchess.com, and unfortunately, I'm still behind on the clock 72% of the time. Working to get better, progress is not just a straight line upward, but I am getting better in the other aspects of your game, which aimchess can measure, which are openings, tactics, endings, advantage capitalization, and resourcefulness. And of course, aimchess automatically gathers your games from the major chess playing sites to give you actionable insights and even quiz you on tactics that you may have missed during your game. So please go to aimchess.com and check out the product. And if you do decide to subscribe, use the promo code perpetual30 to get a discount on aimchess.com. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by BetterHelp.com. If you're struggling with depression, anxiety, or another mental health issue, BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist in under 48 hours. It's professional therapy done securely online. You can schedule weekly video or phone sessions or send a message to your therapist as needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline therapy, and financial aid is available. If you go to their website, you'll see lots of testimonials such as this one. Working with Kendall Bradford on transforming my thought patterns has been very helpful on my journey to improve my mental health. You'll read lots of others like that as well. If you go to the website, BetterHelp.com/chess. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/chess. And if you use that URL, you get 10% off for your first month of use. More details are in the show description. And we are here with who I believe to be the main author of the mammoth book of the world's greatest chess games. He is a FIDE master and a prolific author, and he's spent so much time working on this project, and we're privileged to be able to speak to FM Graham Burgess. Graham, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Yeah, we're excited. So we have so many questions we could ask, but I guess it makes sense, of course, to start at the beginning with this project in particular. What was the genesis of, I know there's two mammoth books in various editions, but particularly the games edition, but just generally the mammoth project?
Well, how long a story do you want? but basically it was a long time ago, I worked for Batsford, used to be sort of like one of the huge players in chess publishing. And by the time I was leaving that company, I was contacted by a company called Robinson, asking if I wanted to write a book called The Mammoth Book of Chess for their series of mammoth books. And anyway, I did that. It's got another very long story short. And around that time, I founded Gambit together with John Nunn and Murray Chandler. And this same company, Robinson, came to us as a company then and said, we'd like another chess book. What would you like to do? So we had a very nice dinner out in a nice restaurant in London, I forget where. And we all sort of had a chat about what sort of another huge chess book would appeal. And the idea of a games book came up. The idea of an openings book or a puzzles book kind of also was floated. But the game sounded like the most fun, and John was quite keen to do that as well. John Ems was also doing some work for Gambit back then. He's now branched off into his own pursuits. So it was a very natural team to write this book. So we defined our plans for the book and sort of what we thought should be in it, and drew up a short list, voted on them, and then we got to work on the book. But yes, it was its company, Robinson, which was founded by a guy called Nick Robinson, who was actually the same Cambridge College as me about 10 years earlier. So it was like a little upstart publishing company with big ambitions. So that kind of was a natural fit for our own little upstart company with big ambitions. Of course, they were much more general publisher. We were obviously just a chess publisher. So it all worked rather well, I think. And bit disappointed it didn't win the Book of the Year prize, but not everything can.
Well, go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to say, are you surprised that it's in a fourth edition now? Like, the first one must have been sometime in the 90s, as I recall, right?
1998, I think.
Yeah, how many books go into four editions? That's a lot.
It's pretty rare, but then the Mammoth Book of Chess is also in its fourth edition around the same time. So, of course, with the Mammoth Book of the World's Greatest Chess Games, the update was kind of natural each time. 12 years have passed, we should have had a few more games. And, of course, you don't need to uproot all the existing material. The new games go at the end because it's chronological order. It was fortunate we made it chronological. Otherwise, if we made it sort of top voting to lowest voting, then we'd have had to reorder everything. So it's a little rare, and there have been some good in-house editors there who've maintained relations with us. And I don't see them that often, living in the US and they're in London. But there have been some good guys there who've... One of the editors was a lady. And they've always been kind of enthusiastic. I'm not quite sure how well the games book has done relative to the Mammoth book. But they can see the chess books can succeed, unlike many publishers and organizations. And so they've been pretty enthusiastic throughout, and they see that this is a long-term seller, so best to keep it in print rather than letting it die.
That's great. So I infer that the regular Mammoth book, the non-games book, that one has sold well?
Yes. I don't have an exact figure. But it's six figures. It's not seven. Many books get to seven. But Bobby Teaches Chess is probably the only seven-figure chess book, isn't it? But it definitely got into six-figure sales. That was in large part because there was sort of like this low-price hardback edition. But the sales have been rather good in total over the four editions. I honestly don't know. I mean, I could go back through a whole bunch of royalty statements, but I don't know how many copies the Mammoth Book of the World's Greatest Chess Games has sold.
Yeah. I mean, and speaking of low prices, Graham, Christopher and I today we're marveling. It's $3 on Kindle today. I don't know if it's always $3 on Kindle.
I think this company, the Robinson, have some ideas about, you know, lowering the price and then raising it again. It's all a bit chaotic, but I think it's to try to get it higher up the Amazon sales charts. And it, once it's got a little high, it tends to stay there and be self-perpetuating. But yeah, I mean, if you want the Kindle edition, then yes, buy it now before the price rises again. But I do recommend the Chess Studio edition. It's obviously much more full-featured.
Yeah, Chess Studio, of course, being the app that one can use to read it. And I'd like to get into the games, Graham. So you guys decided on this project, and then you, even once you know it's a game collection, you still have to sort of get into how to judge the games. And of course, you talk in the introduction about you have the panel that scores the games, but you also talk about that your considerations were quality and brilliance, instructive value, and historical significance. So you're not looking for these sort of one-sided blowouts that there are some famous games in that category. How did you guys come to that decision?
I think John Nunn was a big mover in making sure that it was based on quality rather than sort of flashiness or, of course, most of the games are very flashy, but I think also with his background as a problemist and study solver, false brilliance has always been something that he's found fairly distasteful. And so these games were, it was just someone murdering a much weaker player and decided to sacrifice a whole, queens and rooks and things rather than just win a simple endgame. I think we both find that quite, unimpressive. And games were someone, Well, of course, the question people always ask is why no Morphe games?
Yep.
And that is where the Morphe games fell down. He had a very short career. Most of his games were against players much weaker than himself. His most famous games were absolute crushes of people he could have given queen odds to, or piece odds at least. But there were a number of Morphe games in our shortlist, and of course, we could have gone back after we'd come up with our selection and said, oh, no, we've got to add in something or other. Yeah. But that would have made it kind of fake as well. Yeah, we defined our criteria, we voted, and that was our list, and we didn't tweak it after that point. I mean, you could also say, why are there no games in the 1940s? Okay, not a whole lot of chess was played then, but there was plenty of big tournaments. But we didn't sort of think, we need a quota. You know, it's obviously, if we've been doing the Mammoth Book of the World's Greatest Chess Players, then we'd have started with our list of top players, and we've had a few games from each. But it was kind of weird how that happened, because each of us had at least one Morphe game that would have made our own personal selection, but we didn't choose the same one for that. I think the one of mine that was in my selection was one of his games against Anderson in their match. But again, it was a little kind of one-sided. It was one of Anderson's pretty bad games in that match. But it was a nice win. But the others didn't see it that way. So, maybe marketing-wise, we should have tweaked our selection to make it sort of more pleasing to.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you get asked that a lot, and it was on our list of questions. But on the other hand, I don't know if that's going to cost you book sales, because people aren't necessarily like checking to see what's in there before they buy it. I don't think
it suddenly cost us maybe half a star in the Amazon reviews. Half a star in the Amazon reviews do cost you sales.
I guess that makes sense. Yeah, reviewers can be persnickety. The worst is when sometimes book reviewers will, like, if the book came in poor physical condition, they'll write a bad review of the book. It's like the authors are like, thanks a lot,
Great, yes.
Amazon destroyed my book and I get a bad review for it.
Yes, it does happen, yes.
At least on the $3 Kindles, you avoid the book came in bad condition reviews, I suppose.
You do, yes, or was overpriced or something. But yes, of course, then you get these ones where a book's gone out of print and then it starts selling on the secondhand market and someone says, $900 for this book is outrageous. Right. And again, that's hardly the publisher's or the author's fault.
Yeah, I would recommend they buy 300 copies of the Mammoth Book of the World's Greatest Chess Games instead.
Right.
Well, I have a question, which is, I love the fourth edition so much. When will we have the fifth edition? And is there any chance that you would? So I of course noticed the Morphe games were missing, but I also noticed how few games there were from the 1800s in general. And maybe it's because when I grew up starting to play chess and so on, I was reading a lot of older books, and those older books tended to have a lot more games from the 19th century. And I fully accept that there are many more great games being played these years than there were back then. But have you given any thought at all to looking for ones you might have forgotten? Like if they weren't on your short list that you started from, maybe there are some great games out there that have come to your attention from the past that, you know, you would have put in if you were doing it all over again, even though they're now like past the, you know, the cutoff date and so on and so on. But what about future plans?
I don't think there's any plan to revisit some of the earlier periods. So if there is a future edition, it would, you know, I think we'd follow the plan of adding new games to it. But I did have one thought with the fourth edition of going back over a few games that we didn't include to explain, here's a five famous games that didn't make the cut, just so, you know, as an interesting little piece. But the new games had such lengthy notes, you know, and I certainly wasn't going to cut Wesley or Michael's notes at all to make room for something of my own. So the book was already getting kind of even more huge than it had been. But I don't know. Yes, there's probably more good games played each year than there was in a typical decade in the 19th century. The simple answer is no. We're probably not going to do that. It's a reasonable idea. But that might be better left for other projects. I must also say that in the new edition of Mammoth Book of Chess, one thing I did do was look back over some of the shortlists and the games that didn't make it. I mean, I'm not saying I deliberately chose the substandard games, but these were games that perhaps didn't make it because there was bad opening play or errors, too many errors in them. So I went and found the most interesting part of those and used it in the other Mammoth project. But of course, that was more of the games from the last 30 years or so. And in my book, Chess Highlights of the 20th Century, I did something similar there, choosing fragments from games that were made our shortlist, perhaps had a very nice combination or a nice ending, but the whole game itself wasn't quite of the same quality. So I don't know.
Okay. And you mentioned Grandmaster Michael Adams and Grandmaster Wesley So's involvement, yes, which of course is amazing. You've got Wesley So annotating his own games towards the end. And also just wanted to mention the modern games you reference are excellent selections. I mean, a lot of them were ones I'd seen in the last handful of years, but they kind of escaped my consciousness. And then to see them again already was definitely a treat. But of course, I'm interested in how you got these super grandmasters involved.
Well, of course, one element was COVID. These guys were pretty much sitting at home, twiddling their thumbs, thinking, do I accept this invite to yet another rapid online tournament? And of course, that pays far better, but Wesley, I know for sure, was not enjoying those things, no matter how much money they were bringing in. Now, Wesley just lives just the other side of town from me. In one of his books, he called me his neighbor, which is not literally true. You know, I did have fears that there'd be people coming up to my doorstep wanting to get our neighbor's autographs, but he's the other side of the Twin Cities from me. I know him pretty well. We've met up with him a few times at what used to be the Chess Club in Minneapolis. I'm only 9 hours drive from St. Louis, so I went down to some of the tournaments, particularly when he was winning them. I get on pretty well with Wesley, so it was fairly natural to contact him. And Mickey Adams, well, when I was a teenager, he was like a pre-teener, and he was winning all the tournaments I was playing in, so I've known him for many, many years. That's in the southwest of England. So again, super grandmaster, not many tournaments to play. I tried contacting him. He'd also been involved in quite an interesting project that we'd talked about with him, but in the end he went to another publisher with it, I think because his co-author preferred it. So yeah, I knew he was interested in writing.
I was just going to say, I'll be interviewing him about his new venture with Quality Chess in a few weeks. Right. So, yeah.
Okay, sure. And also, we'd already done some small projects with them. Again, thanks to COVID, I guess you could say, the Desert Island Chess puzzles, where they'd each done one small volume for that, which we then combined into one larger book. So that's how their involvement came in. Trying to make it reasonably simple for them. As we were saying, we want 20 more games. You guys get your shortlist together, vote on it. And I did the player biographies for that new material. And they basically just had to analyze the games and write them up. And they both did a great job, I think. It was, it's super grandmaster. Sometimes you get the big name author and they actually produce something fairly unimpressive. And you then,
I thought Wesley's notes were really instructive in some of the games. Like he has a more conversational style somewhat than I think the rest of you, or at least the original three authors. And sometimes he explained a lot of points that would have gone unnoticed in other games. So it was nice to see like some different approaches to some of the games, especially the newer ones.
That could be partly because of the generation he's from. He knows that you can produce pages and pages of accurate computer generated analysis, and he knows that no one's interested in that. Whereas back in the 1990s, a page of accurate analysis that was something incredible. So it may well be that he knows. Well, okay, I can put a few sentences explaining this, or I could put a page of amazing analysis no one's going to play through. So that might be part of that as well. Sometimes I'd sort of say, hey, you do need to put a variation in here because, this not everywhere, even with all the software, not everyone's going to work it all out to the finish and the conclusion that there should be. So, some of his games do have a little more analysis in them than when he first sort of drafted them. When you have a player with that sort of insight into the game, you do want them putting things into words. He did that. Mickey also as well, I think, gave plenty of verbal explanations. So I think they both kind of nailed it in terms of what we wanted in the project.
I agree. But as the overseer of the project, were there any moments? I mean, obviously we're in the engine age, so I don't know if the engine checked it themselves or if they just did it based on their super GM talents, and then you engine checked it. Were there any sort of errors that you had to gently make them aware of?
I think for all of the people involved in this book, engine checking things as you go along, or at least before you submit it, is just it's just part of the process. So, but what I have found over the years is even if material's been carefully engine checked, further checking will reveal new points. None of it was arrived on my desk sort of not checked, but a really thorough checking of it did lead to there's more to say here, or there's a defense that needs to be considered. There was no real conflicts where they produced something interesting but totally wrong, and of course. You never can be quite sure how accurate would their analysis be if they didn't have a computer check. I guess it would be pretty good, but there would be errors. When you look at Kasparov's analysis from before he started working with the computer all the time, it was amazing, but there would be things missed.
Yeah. And I found it interesting the point you highlighted in the introduction about as you look at the older games, there was a tendency where if there was like an early annotation, particularly by the player in the game, that any wrong analysis would subsequently be repeated once it was initially wrongly analyzed by one of the principals.
I think until the recent times, people didn't realize how many errors there were in chess annotations, even by the top players. I think there was one book where John Munden was doing the Algebraic Classics series, and there was, I think, Reshevsky had given some variation, and it missed a mate in one. And it wasn't just a typo, he just missed a back rank mate or something. And you're just not expecting that until it just hits you in the face so many times, you think, everyone makes mistakes in their analysis. But there was also this thing with Capablanca where errors he would never have made over the board, he would make in his notes. So you got the impression sometimes when they're writing, their brain wasn't fully switched on.
There was some anecdote about Capablanca that he didn't own a chess set at some point, so maybe he was just writing the notes like all blindfold or something like that.
But then again, you'd think he would probably play blindfold chess better than he wrote some of those notes.
Yeah.
Also there was a tournament book, I think it was called about 1911. John Nunn drew attention to this in one of his books. And the tournament book, I think the guy who wrote it, he kind of complained afterwards he wasn't paid very much, so he didn't put much work into it. So a player who was quite capable of writing excellent notes just didn't bother.
Can I come back briefly to the topic of like what might have been in the book but wasn't in the book? So I have two quick questions along those lines.
Sure.
One, we can give up on Morphy because I completely agree with your arguments, but how come you couldn't find a win by Aronian?
There were plenty of games that were influenced by his tremendous ideas and concept, but yes, they weren't ones where he came out on top. It's because we weren't looking for a selection of games in that way.
One that jumped out at me at the end was I was trying to think, what did I not see? You know, like you go through 145 games, they're incredibly great games. Like there are no games I would have taken out of the book, certainly, right? Who might have judged, right? But then I thought, what did I miss? Like, what was not there? You know, and that was the first thing that came to mind was I noticed that there was only two of his losses. But maybe a better question is, like, were there any games that you really wished had gotten in there, but like your co-authors like didn't vote high enough? Like, what would you have put in if you could have like put a couple of extras in yourself?
Well, just before I answer that, another question is, why are there no wins by Michael Adams in there? as one of the authors, I think, have we got two of his losses? But they're both amazing losses. I mean, you know, not everyone can lose games as good as that. As I say, there were no quotas. So I'd have to check the shortlist, but I think there were plenty. An Aronian win over Carlsen was definitely on our shortlist because that's one of the ones that I used in the Mammoth Book of Chess, which was from one of our shortlists. Very nice game, but I don't know. Well, you'd have to ask Mickey and Wesley why they didn't choose that one. But as you say, the 20 they did choose were great games too. Yep. So your question. Oh, get games. I thought. Oh. That's a tough one. There was, I think, one game that I really wished had got in was one of Kramnik's wins over Kasparov from their World Championship match. They won in the Grünfeld. Also felt that was quite instructive as well. So that was one of our criteria. But that was one where it was just me and John Nunn doing the updating. And I think that, We had quite a lot of games where we had to introduce a tiebreaker. And so we had a lot of games getting like 8 or 9 votes. And the tiebreaker was always quality of play. And, of course, the ones which are in that tiebreaker zone where you've elevated into it partly because of the historical significance of it, they tend to fall down at that point. So, yeah, the excellent, you know, the ones that got about 8 or 9 votes, if they were, in a sense, if there were less important games, they had a better chance of making the selection because there were there more because of the quality of the play. That's one that there were probably a number. I mean, obviously, this is 4 editions over many years, and there were a number of personal favorite games that didn't make it in. But whenever there was a game which one of the authors felt had to be in, and then it would make the selection unless one of the other authors felt that it was totally unsuitable. And we did sort of have an agreement that if someone gave it 5 votes out of 5 and someone else gave it 1 out of 5, then there had to be a reason for that. One out of 5 means there is something fundamentally wrong about this game, which means it can't possibly go in. So it should be something you can resolve with analysis or discussion. You know, it should be that, you know, one of the players just made an absolute blunder and, you know, it was, I don't know, it's, there weren't many games that came into that category though. I think there was, Yeah, maybe we should publish our actual voting. And yeah. But we only publish the totals and who annotated it, I think, in the summary in the book. And also, normally the annotator would be someone who gave it the highest vote. So if you gave a game a vote of 5 out of 5 and the others gave it 2 out of 5, then and it made the selection, you would be the one annotating it. So it wasn't like, I think this game's junk, but I've still got to annotate it. That's not going to work very well for anyone.
Oh, I was just going to say, we just have one or two more questions, but in hearing mm-hmm. you discuss the accuracy of the games, which is obviously one of the criteria, as chess has evolved in the past decade since this book's original publication, we're starting to have some ways to measure accuracy numerically. Like, obviously, you could use the Lee Chess Centipawn Loss or the chess.com accuracy score. Those might be somewhat crude. You could probably even enlist a stronger engine and be more exacting in terms of trying to measure it. Do you guys do any, like, as that technology becomes available, do you have any thought of sort of removing the judgment from the quality, air quotes, aspect of the score?
I think there's a fundamental problem with trying to assess games in that way, because more complicated games will, of course, have more errors in them. Yeah. And how is the computer, unless it's an extremely clever AI, how is it going to assess how well the players navigated extraordinary complications? I mean, obviously, Capablanca games will come out at more higher accuracy than Alekhine games. Of course they are. He kept things simple. Yeah. Tile games will have errors in them. Of course they will. But if you turn Capablanca or Karpov into those positions that Tal got into, I doubt they'd have handled them as accurately as he did. So I think that's one reason not to rely on these. And also the ratings they gave some of the players. Did Capablanca have an incredibly high rating from a similar process to that?
Yeah, from Ken Regan's thing, yeah. But I mean, yeah. Capablanca was a pretty good player.
He was, but yet he lost to Alekhine. How can he lose to Alekhine if he's 400 rating points higher than him, really? I'm certainly not picking on Capablanca, absolutely one of the greatest of all time. But when you subject these games to that kind of checking, they are going to come out somewhat flattering compared to some of the other players.
It's an excellent point. And hearing you mention that, it actually, I did, in playing through the games, I felt that a lot of them were kind of on the tactical side. Like, that I didn't feel like there were as many sort of positional wins. Was that something that, like, is that just because if people are choosing, like, their favorite games, do you think it's just going to naturally point in the direction of tactical fireworks?
Well, I mean, one of our criteria was the brilliance of the play.
Right.
So in using the word brilliant, we did have in mind that there had to be some complications, some sacrifices, some attacks. But there are some positional masterpieces in there too. So yeah, we certainly did favor the tactical shootouts, I guess. But particularly the ones where there was absolute mayhem on the board and it lasted many moves. You know, some of these tile games where it was absolutely both players over the precipice for, say 20 moves and neither fell. That to me, and I think to John as well, that's like the real test of a player. If they can find the impossible moves to stay in the game in a position like that, where any slight mistake is fatal. You're saying about the errors in games, because sometimes when we analyze them in more detail to annotate them, we did find the games weren't as accurate as we thought when we voted on them. And again, you could say, well, why not throw some of the games out at that point? But we felt that it's almost the initial impact the game makes is perhaps the biggest point of whether it should be included. You know, if a chess player looks at this game and is inspired by it, then to throw it out because you find some deeply hidden errors in it would kind of be wrong. But I think some of them we did view less favorably after we'd annotated them. I think there was sort of, was it Krogius Stein that John Nunn annotated? And there's a whole series of moves got a question mark from him in that. And, I think he was thinking, maybe with hindsight, that shouldn't have made the cut. But, I mean, any game with weighty ideas that really strikes you as impressive when you first see it, I think it's not a bad choice for a book like this.
Yeah.
But yes, the more modern selection, it's you're going to weed out games with lots of errors quite early on. But one of our top scoring games, the ones that I think were four that got 15, the maximum 15 votes, was of course this Karpov-Kasparov game from 1985, where there was an exchange of inaccuracies in the opening. And people ask, you know, people could ask, well, why has this got your top score? And I think it's partly because it was where it was played. It was, you know, like the decisive game of World Championship match, pretty much. And that the grandiosity of the concept that Kasparov used in that game was just, you know, none of us could give it less than a top score, even with that little blemish early on.
This was the pawn sacrifice in the Sicilian with the knight on with
the knight on D3, yes. The octopus, yes. Or whatever people call it, yeah. Yes.
I remember seeing... I remember seeing the final position of that game was a diagram in the New York Times chess column, you know, back when you had to wait until the next day, yes, at the earliest to find out what happened, you know, and it was all the way from Moscow. And so I have a mental image of seeing that diagram in the New York Times from when it happened. So I can't disagree with that selection at all.
I mean, anyone who was interested in chess at the time that game was played obviously has some kind of special connection with it, I think. I remember it was on... in Britain, they had teletext, and they had the chess page on that. And the moves, yeah, you'd just be watching this page and refreshing it now and then, and a new move would come up and think, wow, that's amazing. and I had a school friend then who was also a good player. He was actually the British under 18 champion that year, Sean Elliott. And so I had someone to compare notes with, you know, when I got back to school each day. And we were both absolutely blown away by this game. And there was also another thing where I was at some weekend tournament once, and I was at the guest house I was staying at. There was a guy who just returned to chess after an absence of about 10 years, and he'd heard the name Kasparov but never seen a game by him. So I had I had the pleasure of sort of saying, well, why not have a look at this one? It's considered one of his best. And yeah, he was just sort of, yeah. It was weird because this was already in the 1990s, and yeah, this guy was sort of seeing this for the first time. It's just kind of a special moment, I guess.
Excellent. Well, the book is filled with special moments. I mean, so many incredible games. As Chris was saying, like, it's easy for me to say, like, why couldn't there have been this in there? But there's nothing I would want to take out. It's a fantastic selection.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Yes, if you're saying, well, get rid of all this junk and put this in, then it's a little disappointing. But no, I think the one thing I do recall is that each game, almost every single game, had one or two really critical moments where you just had to spend hours and hours trying to sort out what was really going on, what should have happened. And I do apologize if that led to some rather lengthy notes, but it's particularly when we were writing the first edition of this, you couldn't just sort of say the engine says this is winning and, you know, you can check it out for yourself if you want. You really had to work through the proof of it yourself and present your evidence, as it were. It's a very memorable book to have worked on. I mean, I'm almost losing count of the books I've written, but I think it's 30. Well, it depends how you count them. I know how many I've written, but I'd say I've written 30 books, but some of them have been through about four editions. Some of them are co-authored. This is certainly one of the more memorable.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, we agree. And thank you, Graham. We'll have to chat again, you and I, sometime if you're up for it, about your other 29 books.
Certainly, you know where to find me.
Excellent. And Chris, do you have any questions before we say goodbye to Graham?
No, that was great. I hope you guys soldier on and come out with the fifth edition. I'll be ready to buy it as soon as it's out.
We'll see. It's hopefully some years off because it's so much work each time. And I don't know if we get Mickey and Wesley again, but we can try.
Yes, excellent work by them. And just as a closing note for listeners, when Chris asked Graham, we can see him, even though this will be audio only, when he asked him about the fifth edition earlier, there was a pained look on Graham's face. So. but Chris persists. So anyway, thanks very much, Graham, and congratulations on the success of this and your other books.
Okay, thank you so much.
Our friends at Chessable keep dropping new courses. Some of their latest include play the Open Sicilian One by Grandmaster Miguel Santos. That's got 15 trainable lines that you can use to play against the Open Sicilian, kind of one-stop shopping for an opening that can be overwhelming to learn. And friend of the pod, Simon Williams, is out with the Harry Attack, fighting kingside fianchettos after 1d4, along with I Am Richard Palliser. And they've got tons of new stuff coming from Grandmaster Hans Niemann, Linyard Dominguez, and the list goes on. And all of their courses, of course, utilize spaced repetition to help you remember the opening or tactical sequence or endgame that you learn. So be sure to go to chessable.com and take a look at what is new.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we are back, and we hope you enjoyed that conversation with FIDE Master Graham Burgess. I certainly did. His knowledge of chess is impressive. And yeah, it's like we were saying before we left you guys, it's just cool to see this sort of lifetime dedication to this project. And it's good to hear that this book has found a lot of fans. And before we left, what Chris and I had been discussing was the structure of the book. We felt like it's really well presented in specific ways. Number one, it has really nice, the first time they show a game from a player, they have little biographies of the player. So you're not reading pages and pages about a person, but it would typically be 2 to 3 paragraphs that give you a sense of their playing style and their accomplishments, and doesn't make you feel like you're just kind of dropping in cold to a game. It gives you some context for the games. And then as Chris alluded to, they have these really nice, you know, everybody loves bullet points, myself included. And at the end of every game, they have 3 lessons from the game where they sort of, highlight things that you can take away from the game, which I do always find to be helpful because especially with older books, that's often lacking.
They have something else too, which is there's a little like one paragraph narrative of the game before the game starts that tells you something about the game itself. After they tell you about the players, they give you like a little prologue that sort of in words describes the struggle, almost like you would describe sort of like a sporting, you know, encounter or something like that, right? It doesn't have moves and variations, but it just sort of says how the advantage, you know, swung back and forth and, you know, what was the critical, you know, the critical moment and so on. Just sort of like nice, gets you ready for like what you're going to see.
Yeah. And then, of course, they quote from different sources along the way, as we talked about with Graham. I mean, sometimes they're, you know, looking at primary sources of other people's annotated games and able to pull in sources there. For any listeners who heard my recent interview with Joel Benjamin and Harold Scott about winning the World Open, we were talking about Grandmaster Edward Gufeld a little bit and discussing his famed Mona Lisa, which I'd seen, you know, I had a little bit of familiarity with that game and then went and looked it up when I read about it in Winning the World Open. And now here it was again in this book. And they had a beautiful poetic quote from Gufeld that they pulled from one of his books. So this is Gufeld after showing this game, which is fantastic, of course. Gufeld's Mona Lisa. He writes, "Every artist dreams of creating his own Mona Lisa and every chess player of playing his own immortal game. No game has given me as much satisfaction as this one. To this day, I feel happiness when remembering it. In such moments, all my failures at the chessboard are forgotten, leaving only the joy of a dream come true." So for any shortcomings that we may have highlighted when discussing Gufeld with Joel and Harold, a very poetic description of a beautiful game. And there's lots of little things like that throughout Mammoth.
Definitely. And it doesn't really overpower you with all that stuff, too. I think it has a relatively light touch. Like, you don't get sort of an encyclopedia of the history of each game and everything that's been written about it and so on. But you do get, you know, some of that flavor and color. So it's not just like variations and so on. And, you know, the textual notes often are excellent little lessons by themselves in like certain pawn structures or certain openings and so on. I was thinking especially of some of Wesley So's notes in the newest edition, actually sort of explain step by step what's going on in the opening, which sometimes the other games don't do, which is fine. You know, not every game needs to be annotated in exactly the same way, but there's a sort of a potpourri of, you know, subtly different approaches to how to explain games as well. But they all do end in those three lessons from every game, which I think are have a lot of pithy and useful bits of advice in them.
Yeah, they definitely do. One that I highlighted was actually one of the games that, Graham discussed, this Krogius Stein game, which Graham said apparently doesn't, you know, has its share of mistakes. But I was pretty impressed by it because it was not one that I like already knew going in. And the lessons from the game for that one are, once you're committed to a sacrificial attack, there is no turning back. And there's lots of sacrificial attacks in this book. And number two is, it's important to recognize that it's difficult to conduct a prolonged defense against a vicious attack. Even though you may feel that it's objectively correct to grab material and weather the storm, you should take into account the human factor. And number three, it very often happens that one error leads to another. The realization that something has gone wrong can easily prove a distraction and lead to a loss of concentration. Be especially careful after you have made a mistake. Another one may be lurking just around the corner. And yeah, obviously that's come up on the podcast before, this idea of trends that Jonathan Rowson has written about in Seven Deadly Chess Sins. But it's always nice when you see these ideas in action in these games.
I think that's a good example of the variety of lessons that they draw too. Like, some of them are psychological, like how should you react, like, to, you know, unexpected things that happen in the game on a psychological level. Like, the engine doesn't care if it just made a mistake, it's going to play just as well afterwards, but we're not that way. So it's sort of alerting ourselves to, you know, the psychology of the game, but also some sort of tips for thinking. Like, one of the first ones I noticed was from a game between Bobby Fischer and Bent Larson from their candidates match in 1971. Which was a game that sort of went into this complicated end game with passed pawns and everything. And they make the point in their advice, decision-making in a messy ending can often be simplified by considering which are the dangerous pawns, the big pawns that are headed for promotion, and how to advance one's own and stop the opponents. So sort of practical advice on like what to focus on with all the moves you can calculate in a really messy, complex position, maybe focus on the, you know, the past pawns that are farthest advanced. It almost seems obvious in retrospect, but when you're at the board and there's so many different things going on and so on, like having a heuristic of what to, you know, how to organize your thinking, I think can be helpful if you can remember these kinds of nuggets.
Yeah, and the one where Fischer trades his knight for a bishop, and, you know, just obviously my regular minor piece trade, except they call it one of the most talked about moves ever, because it was sort of, you know, the knight by appearances was significantly stronger than the bishop. And they have a nice soft touch with that, because they actually, you know, there are moments where like the person who played it, you know, had some sort of deeper or at least alternate understanding than the conventional wisdom at the time. And the engine may or may not have proved them right subsequently, but, you know, they're not too, anything that the engine has subsequently altered the judgment of, they're not too harsh about. They'll point it out, but in a gentle way, which I think is kind of the proper treatment, because, you know, we're all humans.
Yeah. And we're all humans, and these authors are not above some humor. Also, it's not really a book of quips and anecdotes and so on, but they do quite often have like a very dry, you know, wit with these things. Like, for example, in one of the lessons from the game between Karpov and Dorfman, 1976 Soviet championship, which is a game where Karpov sort of, you know, uncharacteristically for his, the way he became later known, engaged in a very sharp sacrificial attack in the Sicilian defense and chased the king around. And he said, the notes say, if you play either side of the Sicilian, study the knight d5 sacrifice, when it works, when it doesn't, what it eats for breakfast, etc.
Right. Yeah.
So like, you know, have intimate knowledge of like the common sacrifices in the opening lines you play, you know, and especially, you know, that one, I think is a good piece of advice.
Yeah. And this book is a good way generally to sort of expose yourself to different openings. I think, at least speaking for me, maybe not for you, Chris, but I feel like I can get trapped in my repertoire a little bit. I mean, obviously I follow top level chess, so sometimes I see openings that I don't play, but certainly I place an undue emphasis on openings I play on my own. Whereas something like this, it just sort of runs the gamut. And again, because because it's not not as many 19th century games, it doesn't have that litany of like Evans Gambits and King's Gambits that you might see in some of the other sort of classic games collections, which to my mind is a good thing.
Yeah, it's got a really diversity of games in all respects. You know, there are lots of very subtle and lengthy end games. There are some, I think there's a couple of games under 20 moves even. The Larson Spassky miniature from the USSR versus the rest of the world match where Larson got crushed in like 17 moves or something is in there. But generally they don't go for those like sort of miniatures. They generally go for more meaty games. I thought I detected a bit of a pattern where like there were some, you know, when there were some short games that Black won, like, you know, Black wins by, you know, by brilliancy or something like that, you know, and, but longer games that White wins. And there is a concentration in some openings too. Like there are a lot of Botvinnik Semislav games.
Yeah, that was one.
These complicated, crazy games with like pass pawns on the seventh rank and so on. You know, they're just fun. They're the kind of games that I think I would say provide a lot of entertainment value, just for like watching a movie, as though you're watching a movie or something like that, you know, instead of as much as learning something about chess.
Yeah, and I've never been a Slav player, so between that and reading the Anon files, I definitely definitely feel my ignorance exposed. I'm just to be a proper chess student, I need to study it more. But
you should put it in your repertoire. Now you're an expert, having studied all these games with it.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, what else do we need to say about this book? I mean, I feel like there's not as much. Chris and I resolved not to just like say such and such game was cool and such game was cool, because that doesn't make for the best podcast. But that really is, when you sit down and read the book, that's what strikes you. It's just like one like incredible, breathtaking spectacle after another. So we'll avoid giving the blow by blow, but I mean, I think in summation, before we get to a couple questions and catch up with Chris, is just a strong recommendation. You know, my only caveat is I didn't love the app, but I did love, especially again with the variations, with so many variations and being able to pick and choose which ones you play through on the app. That alone makes it worth it. But I mean, is there anything else we should say, Chris, about the book?
I have a couple of things I want to talk about. I know I mentioned it in the interview with Graham, but I want to come back and harp some more on the games that aren't there. And I did a little research on this. I even talked to you know, renowned bookseller Fred Wilson about other books like this that he could think of. And I looked into a couple myself. And the game that I saw most often mentioned as one of the greatest games of all time, in fact, I think I saw it mentioned one place as the best game of all time, is not in this book. And we didn't ask Graham about it. It's the game between Bogolyubov and Alekhine in 1922. And it's memorable because there's a queen sacrifice and then like Black's pawn goes to c2 and White can't stop it from queening on c1. And I think Chernev maybe once rated it the best game ever or something like that. Soltis has it as like the fourth best game of the 20th century, you know, and it didn't make it into this book. So I admire the authors of this book for sort of their objective approach. You know, as objective as you can be, it's inherently a subjective choice. What's a great game, right? No computer is going to tell you what games are great and what games aren't great. But they had three people rating them. They used a point rating scale. Like if this were psychological research, that would be pretty high quality, you know, attempts to get at some, to create an objective scale out of subjective judgments, right? You know, you might think that if you got three more grandmasters and had them do the same thing, they might get a similar result as these authors did. But still, there were interesting things that got, you know, that got left out. And that Bogolyubov Alekhine game was the one that that jumped out at me, as well as, of course, the lack of Morphy games. But then when I was playing through it and I thought, you know, who's missing from this? I was surprised they couldn't find the game by Aronian to include. There were two games that he lost, but I couldn't. Yeah. No victories of Aronian's. And considering that he's got like the fourth highest, you know, FIDE rating ever or something like that, and it's not like he's a young guy. Like, well, he's young, but, you know, chess career wise, he's, you know, he's in his 30s. No wins by Nakamura. They have a couple of nice losses, but no wins by Hikaru either. That's why there are other books, right? You can find all those games in other books or other sources. And and so on. But it's kind of interesting how their process resulted in, you know, omitting some people who we normally think of as people in games that we normally think of as like near the absolute, you know, near the absolute top. It's the inherent to any kind of collection like this, right? There's a subjective aspect to it. And part of the interest of it is seeing like what they, you know, what they wound up picking as the best.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I agree that it's nice that they kept the process so pure because I don't know. I would have wanted a Nakamura game, a Nakamura win in there personally. But again, it doesn't detract from the book at all because the games that are in there are so incredible. And as Chris said, like the fact that there's 20, you know, games from within the past decade or so, like, you know, that a couple of them I hadn't seen. So, I mean, there's lots to learn from all of these games.
Yeah. And some that like we watched, like, you know, on, you know, Chess 24 or whatever, like while they were happening, to then go back over them later, you actually like see so much more when you see good annotations of them and all of the, you know, all the alternatives, you know, that were happening and so on. Can I ask you a quiz question, Ben?
Let's do it. Sure.
So intrigued by, you know, who was in the book and who wasn't, I counted up how many games each player has, which wasn't that hard because there's a player index in the back. So I only had to, you know, count a few lines of numbers. So who do you think has the most games won or lost or not many draws in this book, but the most games with any outcome in the book?
Yeah. Well, I was looking when we talked about omissions, I did go to the index then because the famed Fischer Larsen Dragon game, I was like, I don't remember seeing that. So then I went and I sort of saw how many Fischer games there were. And then I was thinking of Alekhine's Gun. So I sort of checked Alekhine. So I know that I feel like there were a handful of each of those. I'm not sure if there was no one just from thinking back and reading it. I don't immediately think of anyone else like definitely having more. So I'm going to go with Alekhine as my answer.
You are way off. the winner going away is Anand.
Wow.
Anand has 14 games. Maybe that's why he was willing to write them a forward or something like that.
Forward, yeah.
I told him you're the most in this book of anybody. 14 Anand games are in there. I didn't count up how many he won and lost. Definitely there's some good losses by him against Carlsen, for example, and Kasparov in the World Championship matches that he lost to both of those. But there are also great, you know, many great wins of his. I'll just tell you the next few in case you're...
Let's hear it.
Tal with 11. So instead of a lot of Alekhine games, there are a lot of Tal games. Some of them sparkling, of course. Then, of course, Kasparov. Fischer has 9. Karpov has 8. But one that was especially high that I hadn't, you know, noticed at the time is Topalov, who also has 10 games. So Topalov actually tied for third most games in the greatest games of all time collection. Now, again, like one of his games is his loss against Kasparov in, I think, 1999, often regarded as the greatest game of all time, where Kasparov chases his king all the way down to, you know, down to the first rank and mates it on the first rank. But a lot of great wins of his, too. Alekhine, only 4 games in this.
So I was right about the handful, but wrong about the comparative.
Yeah,
how
exactly.
That stacks up against.
Yes, exactly. Capablanca only 6. Carlsen only 6. Of course, he still has more, you know, many more years ahead of him, hopefully. Some of the players with the most games who didn't become world champion were Ivanchuk, Caruana, and Shirov. And Caruana did win, I think, at least 3 of those games of the 4 games that they included.
Yeah. And in sort of deconstructing this, you know, what I'd mentioned in the interview with Graham about these games do have, I would say, a tactical bent overall. I do stand by that statement. So it sort of checks out that there's fewer Carlsen games, lots of Shirov games, you know, like Ivanchuk making a sort of out, you know, I don't know about outsized, obviously the guy's a legend, but not a world champion, but several appearances in the book. It does kind of make sense that some of these tactical wizards get overly represented.
Yep. You know, one nice thing they do in the book, which we didn't talk about too much, is they present them in chronological order, which is good because, you know, when you read the biography of a player, in like game 7, and then he shows up again in like game 15 and game 20, they don't have to go back, you know, over it again. But they also in the table of contents print the number of votes that each game got. So you can actually go back and sort of, you know, construct the rankings if you want. And the maximum number of votes a game could get was 15. And I think only 4 games got the full 15 votes. Amazingly, one game that got 14 votes was just played two or 3 years ago, which is a Daniil Dubov game, got 14 votes, which is one off from the most you can possibly get. Also a king hunt game where the king gets chased all the way around the board over onto the queen side and made it on A3 or something like that when it started out on G8, you know, after having been castled.
Yeah. And bringing it back to Anand, there's nice touches like his famous win over Aronian from about 8 years ago. Obviously, like, there's a famous video where Sagar Shah interviews a bunch of people about it, and it's been compared to the legendary Ratlui Rubinstein game. And so it's nice that they like are able to trace it forward and talk about in the sort of lessons from the game, like, know your classics, you know, like, because the resemblance is uncanny between the games. It really can't be a coincidence. And I believe Sagar asked Anand about that at some point, and he mentioned a sort of conscious memory. And there's other little nuggets, like there's another Anand game, which one it is, I'm not going to remember off the top of my head, but where he played prep that he'd been sitting on for 10 years. And there are like little nuggets of just like behind the scenes type stuff where like the opening prep plays like an outsized impression. Obviously that's something, and I think they even mentioned this somewhere in the book, that's kind of taking a back seat now, because like they had a quote from Kasparov where he said, this took me 20 minutes to play at the board, or it might've been 2 minutes to play at the board, but 2 days of preparation leading up to it, like 48 hours of studying the position before you sit down to play it. And then you win the game in using 2 minutes because you've already studied it. Like all those little nuggets about the intense prep and the sort of behind the scenes stuff that, you know, it can still happen, but now everyone's on relatively equal footing with the engines.
I know this is an unpopular opinion, but a lot of people seem to derogate those kinds of games because they say it was all preparation or it was all the computer or something like that. There's always some criticism, you know, of someone for winning by preparation, but preparation is a part of every sport. First of all, There's no sport that doesn't involve preparation. There's no sport that doesn't involve studying the opponent and preparing something for the opponent, you know, and understanding what the opponent is likely to do and not do, or making guesses or predictions or something like that. Right. And to me, one of the great things about this book and about the fact that in chess we can study the famous games like this is that what happens on the board has its own independent significance, regardless of what happened before the move started to get played. So the fact that, you know, Anand, I think it was Anand Adams, where he played this brilliant attack as White and Arroyo Lopez. I think that's the game you were talking about.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, so what? So what? It's a great game. Like, play through the game and you will see, you know, and some of the side variations are even more beautiful, you know, that it's just... it's incredible chess. And that's what the sense I think you get from a lot of these games is kind of like watching a movie or watching a sporting encounter or something like that, where, you know, the advantage passes back and forth. As Graham said, there's like a critical moment, which is something we often talk about in chess. Like, they're always easier to see in hindsight, you know, than at the time, but there's usually some kind of critical moment where the situation is really complex and someone has to make the right decision. And sort of amazingly, these guys did. Well, they're almost all guys. There's, I think, one or two Judith Polgar games in the book. It's just, you know, it's worth, I think it's good for like reminding ourselves like why we're excited about chess also is like, you know, maybe we can't, you know, we're unlikely to ever play a game like this, but, you know, often we have moments in our games which are kind of like this where we discover like a great sacrifice or something like that, or an amazing move, or we get those 2 exclamation points, you know, from the, right, you know, from the app or something like that afterwards or whatever. And I see people post those on social media and stuff like this is the kind of, you know, this is the kind of stuff that like makes us really, really love chess, I think, a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, even what you were saying about the idea of like appreciating the quote beauty of when someone lands some prep, you know, which obviously is taken to its most extreme form when these super grandmasters are playing. But like for you and I, like when you like prepared an opening, even if it wasn't specifically for an opponent, but like you learned a line and it gives you a good position and then you play the position and then you don't screw it up. That's like a magical feeling, you know,
yes.
that we can relate to the superstars on a small level because we do it on a, you know, miniature scale.
Yeah. I have a memory of a game I played once when I was in, I think it was shortly after I was in college, and I was like a 2200 player or something like that, USCF. And I played some game which felt like it was very thematic from start to finish. Like it was, I think it was a French defense or something like that. I was white and you exploit the dark squares in the French defense and you trade off the dark squared bishop and you infiltrate on the dark squares and so on. And I said to one of my teammates, it was a league match afterwards. I said, wow, that was one of the first games I can remember playing that I really felt like it went exactly the way I wanted it to the whole time. Like I really understood what was going on all the time. Not that it was a quick crush or anything like that. It was sort of like a slow, you know, win. But any, you know, these kind of games, I think, can show you like how, you know, well, as you say, a lot of these games are more concrete and tactical, but still they can show you how those positional ideas, you know, can be sort of followed through, but also just, you know, the joy of what we're aiming for. And if you're, you know, if you watch some Grandmaster tournament online and you're like, oh, all the games were drawn this round, you know, well, pick up this book or some book like it, you know, and look at some of those. And then you'll remember that, you know, for all the draws that get played, you know, even the great ones, you know, there are so many great decisive games as well that are interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, again, strong recommendation. It will keep you busy for a long time. Great value. You can grow into it. Is there anything else to add before we get to our sort of unrelated catch up, Chris?
I don't think the last thing I'll say is like they really should have put in more engine games. There's one engine game which is Deep Blue versus Kasparov, game one from their first match, which is sort of like the less famous of the Deep Blue Kasparov games. It's not the one where Kasparov resigned in a drawn position, which probably was omitted from the game because the loser resigned in a drawn position, which is right. Probably dings it on the quality scale, you know, like a massive mistake by Kasparov on the last move of the game. The historical significance scale couldn't go up high enough, you know, to compensate for that mistake. But like a couple of the AlphaZero Stockfish games, I think, you know, everybody was so amazed by those games when they came out, you know, I think there are so many great engine games that really show us like new possibilities about chess. And you've talked about it with like Matthew Sadler and people like that, you know, quite a bit. I think those games deserve to be in like collections of great games because it's not great games by humans. It's great games, you know? So there might be less drama when computers are playing each other, but there might be like other compensating factors. So that's all I'll add, but you know, when they do the fifth edition, maybe they'll come around.
Yeah, I have to admit, I come down on the other side of this argument, Chris. Even though I love Matthew Sadler's book, and I know there's tons to learn from engine games, to me, it still, and I know we've talked about this in prior interviews, it just, in this book, it left me a little cold. I was just can't get fired up for an engine game when there's all these giants playing.
But didn't you love that AlphaZero game where like white plays queen e4 and queen h4 and queen h1 and sacks a piece and just plays down a piece and so on? Wasn't that just one of the most amazing chess games I ever saw?
They're amazing games. It's just they feel out of place to me. I don't know. I still consider something like this like the human history of chess. I mean, it's the author's decision, and obviously I'm still a huge fan of the book, but to me, I wouldn't want more personally. But
you probably don't like watching robots play soccer either.
Exactly.
You're one of those people.
No, but I mean, it's not the same. Obviously, there is tons to learn from it. It's just I feel like it deserves its own little island.
Yeah.
Is generally my opinion. So okay, let's get to these Patreon questions, Chris, because you're always a popular guest. And we have a question from Tyron Ross Price. Shout out to Tyron, who asks, he says, does Dr. Shabri have any book recommendations with actionable scientific information for aging chess players looking to keep their cognitive skills as sharp as possible for as long as possible? Maybe there could be a new podcast series beyond Adult Improver called Senior Sustainer. How in the world did Korchnoi stay strong for so long?
Well, that's a lot of questions. I mean, the question I think sort of points to some of the answer, and I hate to be pessimistic, but I think like at a certain point, sustaining your level is as much of a victory as raising your level, because there is sadly a natural, you know, change over time in some of our cognitive abilities. And I think we've talked about this before, like, you know, fluid intelligence which is kind of what we're using when we're calculating during the game, you know, does tend to sort of, you know, go down, especially like probably starting in your 50s is sort of, you know, when, you know, when that probably tends to happen more. Now you can find like, there are always new studies coming out on this. When does it peak? When does it, how steep is the slope? You know, what exactly is going on? I think the place to look for actionable advice is not in the literature that tells you to play brain games or to do crossword puzzles or whatever. Those are all fun things to do. Although brain games usually seem boring to me. That seems like torture and they don't really work. But probably things like exercise, diet, sleep, and maybe trying to play when you're at your best. Because I've noticed myself, the older I get, I feel like the more my level varies during the day and during the week. So if I'm playing like a League Chess League game on a weeknight after I've been working all day and been up for 12 hours already, I'm much worse than if I play it, let's say, Saturday afternoon or something like that. Now we can't control like when our over the board tournaments usually are. They always, you know, in the US, right, they have this jam-packed schedule where they try to cram in, you know, five slow games in a weekend. So we're kind of stuck with that. But I have noticed that some older players, like I've noticed, I mean, not to cast any aspersions, like Larry Kaufman's a great player, but he's not the youngest player either. And I've noticed that he takes buys you know, when he plays in a weekend tournament. I mean, he's probably not trying to win the whole tournament. He's there to play interesting chess and have fun, you know, and maybe get some food for thought for his next opening repertoire book or something like that. But he'll take some buys, right? So that he probably, because he thinks he maximizes his level and his enjoyment of the game. You don't have to play like all five rounds or whatever, you know? So I would say look to those kinds of like self-management things rather than a way of like boosting your brain. Like exercise, I think, goes a long way. Aerobic exercise, especially, being generally healthy is probably the best you can do. And then in terms of, you know, chess exercises, I'm not a chess trainer, right? You know, I have my own coach, you know, I don't want to like give anybody coaching advice when I don't, you know, coach anybody myself, but, the concrete knowledge is probably not what you're going to lose, right? And if you're an older player, you probably have absorbed a lot of concrete knowledge already. You've probably played over a lot of the classics, you know, and you just have come across them, you know, and you probably read a lot of books like about positional chess and so on. But it's the pattern recognition and the calculation, right, that are the things that can, I think, I even notice like after a few days, right, if I don't do tactics, I feel like my tactical vision is a little bit worse, you know? So I think keeping up with that stuff is important when you're, you know, when you're, as you, you know, as you age. There was, I mean, also I did, you know, you did give me this question in advance and it occurred to me that there's a very recent book that came out that I haven't really dipped into very much, but it looks really interesting. It's called, Cognitive Chess, by a guy named Konstantin Chernyshov. I'll give you the details. It's a Russell Enterprises book and it's a lot of like blindfold calculation exercises and visualization exercises. Those obviously are becoming more and more popular these days. You know, done them on the show and so on, but I think there's probably some value in doing those kinds of, exercises as well. The farther you get into your career, let's put it that way.
Okay. Tons of great advice there. Yeah. And what you say about sort of the away from the board approach about, managing your energy and taking buys and being fit, that really resonates. These are traits that take on an added import as we get older, even away from the board. So you know, even if you're wrong,
I don't think any of this advice is special to chess, really. I think it improves your performance in most aspects of life. Right. It's sort of obvious advice, I suppose, but we often think that chess advice has to be about chess, right? Whereas it's a performance, you know, activity, right? And it's not a trivia quiz, you know.
Yeah.
It's like a skilled performance under time constraints activity. You know, it's not a, you know, it's not a history test or something, right? So, you know, all those things are going to matter.
Well said. Yeah. So great question from Tyron and shout out to all the senior sustainers. I love it. and the other Patreon question is from Alex Friedman, which is a simpler question, which is just, does chess have a Mozart effect? And the Mozart effect, correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, but basically the idea is that if you're listening to classical music while you are engaged in some sort of study, it may trigger positive emotions that help you retain things or think more clearly. Is that about right?
No, it's even more. I mean, it's even more. I mean, I'll say more absurd than that. I mean, it's absurd in hindsight. It was a popular and, you know, sort of somewhat widely believed scientific claim in the 90s that if you listen to Mozart's music before you do a cognitive test, like an IQ test, let's say, or an SAT or something like that, you'll do better on the test by a lot than if you had just like been in silence beforehand or listened to noise or, you know, rock music or something like that. And basically that turned out to not be true. It was just the original study that made that claim got a lot of publicity, but other people couldn't replicate it. You know, there is no known benefit from listening to classical music, you know, before you do something. So if the question is, should I listen to classical music before I sit down at the chessboard to play? I would say, if you like classical music, go ahead. If you like to listen to it while you're playing and the rules allow it, that's fine too. But there's no solid evidence that that's, you know, inherently going to make you any better or worse. Another way of interpreting the question, though, is, you know, Mozart's music is sort of like, you know, I don't know much about classical music, but it's like the genius, you know, among the genius works of music, right? So could playing over the classics of chess, like, make you better at chess or something like that? You know, well, I think the answer is yes. Like, you know, we just talked about it, and I don't think it's a terrible warm-up activity, you know, before a future tournament to play over some classics. At the very least, there might be inspiration from it, if not some concrete, you know, knowledge that you gain or something like that. And also the other connection between the Mozart effect and chess is that, you know, chess and classical music are both the kinds of activities that are really associated with, you know, intellectualism, you know, high intelligence, academic success, all of that. I think that is sort of part of the reason why people think that like playing chess is going to make you smarter, or it's going to improve your thinking skills. And I think the evidence is very mixed that it will actually make you smarter. But I think it's reasonable to believe that it sort of fosters some good mental habits of concentration and, you know, sustained attention and, you know, being able to study things and make plans and all that kind of stuff, even though those things don't necessarily show up on, let's say, IQ tests or math tests or whatever. And we've talked about that before. And I think it's still true that, you know, you shouldn't get involved in chess just because you think it's going to make you smarter. But on the other hand, it will probably do more for you than a lot of other activities that you could be doing at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, it could be the placebo effect, but I definitely, since I've been competing regularly, I sort of, I feel an increased sharpness, maybe not when I'm playing, but the rest of the time, at least.
That's because now you feel like a real chess player, and a real chess player is sharp and smart and so on. Before, when you were just doing a podcast, you didn't feel like a real chess player. Now you're back feeling like a real player. I sort of agree with you. I think we talked about this maybe in the first time I was on, that like one of the most unique experiences of chess is like sitting at the board and doing one thing for five straight hours.
Yeah, exactly.
Concentrating. And like it sort of, you know, especially for people like me who are not like athletic and so on, it really gives you a feeling of like performance skill, especially if you win a game. You know, if you win a nice game, it's like, wow, it's like, you know, you feel like you get a feeling of mental power or something from it. Whether that means you're any smarter, I don't think so, but it certainly is a, you know, it's a psychological boost that you know, that is not nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Well, Chris, thanks for the great insights. And last thing before we say our goodbyes, you did tell me in online chat that you're plugging away at a book, a non-chess related book, although there will be some chess in it. Can you reveal any more details for our listeners?
I can't reveal any more details because my co-author and I have not decided whether and when we're going to reveal any details, let alone like discussed it with the publisher. But if all goes well, in about, you know, a year or so, there will be another book out from with my name on the cover. And I think it will be of interest to chess players, even though it's not a chess book. It's a general audience book, kind of like The Invisible Gorilla was. But I think it will be of interest to people who play chess and other games and anybody who's really, it should be of interest to everybody. That's, you know, that's the audience. Yeah. Everybody must buy this book. But
excellent.
Chess players will be certain to find some interesting things in it.
And we'll be sure to have you on to discuss it, to do our part in haranguing people as we should.
All right. Sorry to be so mysterious, but I look forward to coming back and talking about it, whatever it is.
Excellent. Yeah. And one last housekeeping note for anyone listening. This is the March Chess Books Recaptured, and I may, believe it or not, skip April. I'm working on potentially lining up a special guest, in which case there will be an April book recap. But if that doesn't happen, I'm interviewing some authors for the regular interview show, and I need a month to catch my breath. So if it may or may not appear in April, but if not, we'll be back in May. So Chris, thanks as always. This has been fantastic. Thanks for the great suggestion. And yeah, in summation, definitely recommend listeners pick up Mammoth Book of Games in your preferred format.
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me, and look forward to next time.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Beneficial1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next episode.
Podcast Network.